Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest was just in town to speak at the Chicago Humanities Festival. Molly Crabapple is an artist, a journalist, and an author. Her illustrated memoir, Drawing Blood, came out a couple years back, which chronicled her life from living in a bookstore in Paris to sketching court proceedings at Guantanamo Bay. Her work is stunning. It uses photos from war-torn areas of the globe, then using ink to sketch the photos, making artistic, powerful, in a way, making them more real. Crabapple's new book is called Brothers of the Gun, A Memoir of the Syrian War. It's co-written by exiled Syrian journalist Marwan Hisham, and it's illustrated by Crabapple. The memoir is a stunning look at life and revolution and a life lived in a country torn apart by war, politics, and ideology. Also, just a life lived. That's the beauty of it. Marwan and Molly have worked together to bring sketches alive through places like Vanity Fair, but now the whole story is in memoir form. Molly's also worked for the New York Times, Vice, and The Guardian, just to name a few. Like I said, Crabapple in town for the Chicago Humanities Festival. She's my guest tonight at the big table. Molly, thanks for being here.
Oh, man, thank you so much for having me.
Let's talk about this first, Brothers of the Gun. You have worked with Marwan before in bringing some of these excerpts to life through Vanity Fair, like I mentioned, some other places. Talk about putting this together, having this actually done. What's it mean to you to have this book out?
It's the hardest and most precious thing I've ever done in my life, probably. Me and Marwan, we got to know each other on Twitter in 2014. Initially, we just were people that would make snarky jokes at each other on Twitter. And then I started learning Arabic, and he started helping me with that. And our collaboration started because I asked him, I was like, hey, Marwan, do you have those photos on your phone of daily life? The kind that, you know, we all have lots of photos. And he was like, yeah, sure, I'll give you some photos from Raqqa. And then instead, like a lunatic, he goes around and sneaks all around the city and takes these surreptitious photos of life under ISIS, something I never would have wanted him to do because it's so incredibly dangerous, but he did that. And he gave them to me to draw from. And it was the most surreal and intense thing to be able to see the city that the only way a Western journalist went into Raqqa was in an orange jumpsuit to be in an execution video. And to see that city through his eyes and to know all the risk that he took for that. So we published that initial collaboration in Vanity Fair. And Marwan had told me that he liked to write political commentaries just in his spare time. And so I said, why don't you write some captions for this and introduce people to Raqqa a bit? It's your hometown. And he wrote those. And from that, we did a series of collaborations. He went to Mosul and later to rebel-held East Aleppo and then later finally to Turkey, where I met him in person. But to do the memoir was something entirely different than that. To do the memoir was like excavating memories, excavating the most raw and hidden, perhaps, parts of one's brain and one's past and trying to create something true. Marwan is an incredibly sarcastic, impious person. And by impious, I mean skeptical of the dogmas that are usually imposed on people. He's not someone who belongs to any ideology except his own and who only listens to his own conscience. And so it was amazing to look at a war like Syria that's so driven by ideology, that's so driven by people who look at, you know, teams and geopolitics, and work with someone who is such an individual and who had such a strong inner voice to bring his memories to life.
As an artist, to get this project started and then to recognize that Marwan is sending you photos from an area that you can get a lot of trouble for doing that, what did you expect to get? What was the expectation? Were you just assuming it'd be, okay, he's going to go to the town square and he's going to grab a couple pictures, or, oh, this could be the worst? Talk about your expectations of receiving those photos.
So I didn't think he was going to take any new photos for me. I never would have asked someone to take photos in Raqqa for me. That's be crazy. I thought that he probably just had a bunch of photos on his phone already, right? I got 1,000 selfies on my phone, certainly. But in terms of what it was like to get them, so ISIS bans photojournalism. The only images from ISIS territory are either their own depraved propaganda or it's stuff that really, really brave activists are sneaking. And photos like that, they're not taken with craft or skill. They're taken by people who are desperately trying not to get caught.
Absolutely, right.
And so what I wanted to do was I wanted to create imagery of life in ISIS-occupied city that had all of the craft and rigor and care that photojournalism does, and I wanted people to look.
The sketches in the book, Brothers of the Gun, A Memoir of the Syrian War, they're stunning. I mean, everything about it, because your artwork is stunning. There's a lot about it where you're like, that is an amazing, even on the cover of, you know, someone playing a machine gun like a violin, and it's a sketch. It's almost more real than if you had a picture of this. When you think about the project, and this project you mentioned, 2014, 2015, the book is out now, it's 2018. Raqqa is an entirely different city, and a lot of the landscape, and I would assume a lot of the backdrop of the sketches and the work that you did are not there anymore. The bombing hadn't happened. The Americans hadn't come in. A lot has changed. How do you feel about that? How do you feel about having this almost captured in a moment and knowing that a lot of the stuff is not there anymore?
You know, it's a strange thing. It's quite melancholy, right? I remember when ISIS finally left Mosul. One of their last acts was that they destroyed this very, very, very famous, very old mosque in Mosul. And I remember watching that on Twitter. And we were talking with Marwan and we were saying how happy we were that we had captured that. At this point, 90% of Raqqa was destroyed by the American bombing campaign. Mm-hmm. Much of what we drew in East Aleppo is destroyed. Turkey has just invaded Afrin, which we also mm-hmm. drew. So these are things that are gone, that no one will ever be able to sketch from life again. No one will ever be able to take pictures of them again. And I suppose I feel privileged, very, very privileged to have drawn them. But what an intense tragedy their loss is.
And there's something to be said about the archive, any sort of photo archive of a place that is now markedly different. And that's what I think is really stunning and really powerful about your work, is that because you took the time to sketch, to make this a piece of art, those backdrops, even some of the simple stuff, like just what's happening in the town square or what's happening in someone's living room, it's not the same anymore.
Yeah, it's not the same anymore at all. I mean, the U.S., as is their wont, is not rebuilding Raqqa, just like they did not do a good job of rebuilding Baghdad in Iraq. There's still no power and there's still no water. People still can't go back to their homes because there are rotting bodies inside them very often. And so even the pictures that are just from, like, you know, normal, right. you know, life, that normal life has fundamentally changed.
Molly Crabapple's my guest. She's an artist, an illustrator. She's a journalist. She's an author. Her latest, Brothers of the Gun, co-written memoir of the Syrian War with Marwan Hisham. She was just in town for the Chicago Humanities Festival. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back and we'll talk more about your career. Molly Crabapple in studio. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, my guest tonight at the big table, Molly Crabapple, who's an illustrator, she's a journalist, an author. Brothers of the Gun, A Memoir of the Syrian War is her latest. She co-wrote it with Marwan Hisham. She took a lot of Marwan's photography and sketched it out. It's unbelievable, powerful stuff in this book. And also, of course, she did her memoir, her illustrated memoir, Drawing Blood, back in 2015. You've got such an interesting story, how you got here, how you became one of the more well-known illustrators in this country, in the world, really. Let's go to New York. Let's go to Manhattan. Let's go to down by Wall Street and how you started working at the Box, the nightclub, and started your career, essentially your art career, almost began in earnest at this point. Talk about that experience.
Oh, man. So I was 24. I must have been like 24 years old. It's crazy that because it was right during the financial crash, which was 10 years ago. So I was 24 years old. And Box was the most depraved, crazy, rich, elite, gorgeous horror show in the city. It was the type of place where you have like Saudi royals and bankers that wrecked the economy.
Stuff we didn't even know exist.
Right? Exactly. And on stage, you have like some beautiful woman who's a crazy circus performer doing a backflip and catching herself with her feet before her head would be cut off with a chainsaw. I mean, it was madness. It was absolute madness. And it was also, it was so gorgeous, but it was so on edge, right? Because we as performers were all broke and we are surrounded by these very, very rich people who are quite horrid. And they have contempt for us and we had contempt for them. But also, like, my performer friends wanted their money and they thought my performer friends were hot. And so, you know.
Yeah. And talk about what you were doing. I mean, you were doing sketches at the club.
So I talked my way into being the club's official Toulouse-Lautrec. I sat in the corner many nights every week and I drew all the madness around me. And I convinced my boss at the box to let me make their symbol a pig snorting cocaine.
Good. It was a very persuasive argument. But,
well, it's true, you know?
Yeah. But to be in that environment, to be in a decadent environment like that, right in the shadows of Wall Street in New York City, right before the economic crash, to think about that experience and what you've done since that time, when you were there when the economy crashed and Wall Street changed and you were right there in the shadows, what convinced you to move on from that place? What was it about your experience being in that area that really started moving you towards the career you have now?
Well, I actually think a lot of the skills that I use as a journalist are very similar to what I use as a nightclub artist. You draw fast, right? You learn to simplify. You learn to get the truth in as few lines as you can because things are going to move really, really fast. But I think in many ways, the box was the best training for what I did. I always think back to Toulouse-Lautrec's Moulin Rouge, which was a similar place in a lot of ways. It was a place where, like, European aristocrats might be in the audience, right, but where the performers were these tough as nails, you know, usually sex workers, who would kick the hat off of the head of the Prince of Wales just to show, like, okay, you own the world, but in here I'm queen of this place. So for me, it was nightclub as class war at the box, and it was a perfect preparation.
And really got your name in witness journalism and sketching through your work with Occupy Wall Street, a movement that we're very familiar with, and it became front page news after the economic crash. Activists and protesters went down to Wall Street and really started a movement to say enough is enough of the inequality in this country and the 1%. It became a huge, huge movement, and it was documented well. And there's so much made about that witness journalism, people being able to turn their cameras on or turn their phones on or whatever it might be. And in your case, you took the skills that you had as a sketch artist and you sketched that movement. I saw a lot of that stuff. That became almost an artistic way to look at what was happening in Wall Street. How did you get into it?
Occupy Wall Street happened about half a block away from me. I got into it because it was right next to me. You know, so I have always gone to protests. My dad is Marxist. I went to a lot of anti-Iraq war protests, especially. But there's always this aspect about going to protests, which reminded me of going to church when you don't really believe in God, but aren't totally sure. And you think, like, well, it's probably, you know, it's not going to do any harm, you know, if I go to church and it's, you know, a good thing, but you don't really expect anything to happen.
Right.
And Occupy was different. Occupy, when I was there, was the first time when I actually saw power be threatened. I mean, they were scared, right? That's why they reacted with such violence to it, because they were scared. And so I wanted to support that however I could. And for me, the way to support that was by drawing.
To think about that movement and or the identity of that movement was to speak truth to power and the power's reaction. And we saw a lot of harrowing images of police and full arrests and trying to take back a little park in New York City, right in Wall Street. But we saw this thing that was happening that a lot of people, I think, around the country fundamentally agreed with, this idea of the way that power and money was at the top and the rest of us be damned, even to the point of crashing the economy, manifesting it through the eyes of kids. Really, this movement of kids that were changing the world. To be in that moment, to be there, to be the person who was in charge of doing that fast sketch, as you talked about, and capturing that moment. Did you feel a responsibility? Were you sketching for the protesters, or were you sketching for the world to see it?
Sometimes both. Sometimes I would make signs for the protesters, and within an hour after them being online, they'd be on the streets. Other times, I would just be documenting in my own sketchbook. For me, it was probably the most vivid time of my life. There are certain times where, just for some magic reason, right, the rhythm to which your heart is beating, I guess, the rhythm to which that you're living is just in tune to that which the world is moving. And when you're in that moment, everything you do, it just feels right and it feels significant. And the friendships you make there are the ones that last forever, right? The art that you make there is so raw. And that only lasts for one brief thing. I mean, Occupy lasted 3 months, I think.
Yeah, right. Had such a lasting impact.
Exactly, exactly. But those networks that came out of Occupy, those friendships, those skills, those experiences, those are still around right now. And I've often thought that not just me, but many of my friends were still kind of like this class of 2011 that came into ourselves during that moment.
Molly Crabapple's my guest. She's an artist, sketch artist, journalist, and the author of Brothers of the Gun, a memoir of the Syrian war, co-written with Marwan Hisham. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll get an update on tonight's news. We'll come back. And I want to continue because you've done so much beyond. I mean, we're talking about Occupy Chicago or Wall Street, which, you know, now we're, you said 10 plus years ago. You've done much since then. And I want to talk about Guantanamo Bay and some other aspects of what you've done with your work and your art. Molly Crabapple, just in town to be at the Chicago Humanities Festival, my guest tonight at the big table. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest in studio tonight, Molly Crabapple, a great sketch artist, illustrator, journalist, author. Her new book, Brothers of the Gun, a memoir of the Syrian war. She co-wrote it with Marwan Hisham, which takes a look at life, normal life, in 2014, 2015 in Raqqa, Syria. Marwan and two of his friends, essentially, talking about what happened from the protests at the beginning of what we knew to be the Syrian conflict and, of course, what has happened since. You, as an illustrator, I want to talk about perception. Think about two things. I think about sketches in general, just the art form of sketches. And for whatever reason, we see them play out more often than anywhere else, either in a museum or a gallery or in a courtroom. And I wonder how that messes with our perception, because you've done a tremendous job with this stuff, where it automatically makes me, I have to get past my perception to go, "This, you took a photo and you did this. This is amazing. This is not just you sort of seeing something and doing it." But also in a lot of your work, you are able to put political commentary, your own artistic statement on it. So it may not necessarily be a full just sketch as we know it, like a courtroom thing, like here it is. You're making it much more nuanced. Talk about getting over that perception as people who consume your art or appreciate your art have to almost get past the way we know sketches in this world.
Oh, it's totally true. Because the thing about the difference between a sketch and a photo is that a photo is proof, right? Or it's supposed to be. I mean, obviously there's, you know, Photoshop, but in general, when you see a photo, you think that's something that happened. Whereas with a sketch, it has no such a burden on it, which right. often gives you a great deal of freedom. And I need to actually talk a little bit about the process of the work that I did in Brothers of the Gun. All my initial collaborations with Marwan were from his photos, but Brothers of the Gun was a little different because it actually takes place across his whole life. And so things...
So you have to almost take the passage and sketch
exactly.
the passage, right?
And so what we would do was... I let him art direct me more than anyone has ever been allowed to art direct me in my life because I'm a little egomaniac. But what we would do is he would describe really closely something. Like he'd say, this was... there are these two women, and they were, you know, Yazidi women, and one of them was holding her baby. And he'd be like, this is how old one was, and this is how her hands were held, and, you know, make her hands careless. Don't make it some fake, cheesy Madonna and child, like, Christian thing. No, it has to be real. And, like, the girl, make her younger, but also make her eyes like this. And we would work together, and we'd do sketch after sketch after sketch after sketch. And I would look at, like, for instance, how Yazidi women might typically dress. Also, I'd look at maybe some of my own sketches because I had been in Iraq and I'd also spent some time with mm-hmm. Kurds, including Yazidi Kurds in Iraq. And we would use all of this reference and all of these memories and work to get something that was as true as possible where no photo reference existed.
As someone who's worldly in the fact that, as I mentioned in the lead, you lived in a bookstore in Paris and you just mentioned you spent your life in different places. And I think about the American perception of the Middle East. And I know this, and you've referenced this before as well, that most time we see any photography or imagery that is coming from the Middle East, it's surrounding war. It's surrounding some sort of chaos. That's something that I think is because the nature of the way that news is given to us. Rarely do we see normal life. You know, the idea of people just living in Raqqa, Syria. Do you have to think about that as well? Do you have to get over your perceived stereotypes or notions when you're talking with Marwan and he's saying, it's this, this, and this? Do you as an artist have to be like, almost push back against what your automatic thought is on that because of the way that we've been conditioned?
So when I started reporting in the Middle East, yes, but I've, you know, it's been some years
yeah,
now.
Right.
So I've been 5 years about reporting on the Middle East. And also, it's not just about the Middle East. It's that I'm not a survivor of a war. I am not someone who has lived in a city that was being continuously bombed. And I think that when you haven't lived through that, you have a perception of what you think it will be like, and you think it will be this state of exception, right? But that for people who have actually lived through atrocities, people who have lived through war, people who have, like, I was recently reading the memoirs of someone who had survived the Warsaw Ghetto, for instance. Mm-hmm. The thing about that is actually things stay normal and feel normal for so long. You don't actually get into that state of exception when you're living it. That's something that you imagine will happen but doesn't.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, and it's something we don't think about if you never lived through it. You think if the bomb started falling in Chicago right now, we would all be in a chaotic sense of extended chaos. But the fact is that that may not be true.
Yeah, the human brain very quickly adapts to pretty much anything you put it in. It's the same reason that people who win the lottery don't stay happy forever, because the human brain just adapts to them being lottery winners within like a week. Something very, very similar happens when you're going through horror. And it's not that you're not, you know, traumatized and suffering and all of that, but just to survive, the human brain will put you into a mode where you can, mm-hmm. you know, live and put your foot forward.
You have had a tremendous life, and you're so young to have had the experiences that you've had. And I think about the life of an artist, because going back to being in your early 20s and sketching for, I would assume, for a little pay at the box, but other ways to scrape by to be an artist. Now, here you are with your second book. You've got a lot of opportunities, and things may be a lot different. But you were an independent artist who said no to the gallery system. You said no to the traditional ways that artists have been able to make money. And you had to kind of find your way. Why? Why didn't you just say, you know what, these sketches are great, I'm going to go through the gallery system, these sketches are great, I'm going to get, you know, try to find a teaching job or whatever it might be for artists. Why take the hard route?
I mean, to be honest, I would say the gallery world said no to me. I don't think I had that option. I mean, I dropped out of school, man. I can't get a teaching job. I don't have a college degree. And in terms of galleries, I never knew how to speak their language. There's like some special way that people speak in the art world that I assume you learn, but I don't know how to do it. And now I have a lovely gallery in New York that occasionally sells a piece, but through most of my career I didn't have that, and I don't think it was a terrible loss. I think that the model of, you know, work all year on specs, putting all your own money into something and then put it in a room for a month and then hope things sell, I don't think it's necessarily
not a great model.
Yeah, not a great model for financial stability. I don't know. I just never had an option to do anything secure. I mean, I'm not good at anything except these things. I'm lazy and willful and stubborn, so I don't know what I would have done. I think this is my only option.
I found an article that Cory Doctorow did on his book, and Cory's been on the show. He asked you to write about how to be successful on the internet and when it comes to being an artist. But you had a number of things. That's 15 things. But five, you said, I never had a big break. I've had tiny cracks in this wall of indifference until finally the wall wasn't there anymore. What does that mean?
Well, it means that, so there's this idea that one day there's going to be this great gallery and they're going to step down and they're going to be like, you are a genius and here's a big show and lots of collectors and lots of money for you, and it's all taken care of now, and that's your reward for working so hard and being so humble. But that never happened to me. I've had some amazing opportunities, right? But even those opportunities don't feel like the big break. Like working on a book for 3 years is... it's a grind, man. It's a really, really hard grind, and it's something precious and that I feel so lucky to do, but it's also a grind. And doing a gallery show after you've been working for 14 years or whatever, it's awesome, of course, but it only feels like an incremental thing. But I've never, ever had someone just step down and be like, Molly Crabapple, here's your $1 million grant.
One of those people who might have been in the box is like, I remember your sketches. Here's $1 million.
Yeah. No, none of that. None of that. I think they're pretty mad at me for the first book.
Well, I wonder, too, because a lot of artists out there want to go it their own way. They want to be independent. They want to find ways to find their niche. And I think of your work and what you've done and what you stand for as an artist. And you recognize that I think that means that you have to keep working hard, even when opportunities come your way and money comes your way. You have to keep working hard. And it's not all going to be given to you, you know, as advice for a younger artist. If I'm an artist and I'm listening to this right now, what's your advice for someone who might be 22, 23 years old, who may have similar skills, who may feel like they have, because it's not that marketable, meaning being a sketch artist, there's not like, please, the world is yours. It's a difficult thing, and it's not necessarily one that has money attached to it.
First off, I would say that I wish we lived in a civilized country with public arts funding, and also a country that didn't believe in letting people die on the street of cancer because they didn't have a full-time marketing job. I wish that we lived in a socialist and civilized country, but we don't. So all of my advice is with that in mind. The first thing I would say is that everything in the world is breaking up right now, and it's in this sense of complete chaos. All these institutions are collapsing. And so because of that, the one good thing about being in a time of chaos is that there's no, like, the man isn't telling you have to be one way, right? Because the man doesn't know what the hell is going on.
Right.
So what I would suggest is to be yourself and to follow what are the things that obsess you, that you're passionate about, but to do it with, like, such rigor and to do it with such skill, with to do it as best you can. Because everyone that I've seen who has been really, really successful, they all do things that no one would have imagined before. One amazing friend I have, Tatiana Fazlilizade, I always shout her out. She got tired of men harassing her on the street and men always saying, like, hey, baby, smile. So she did a self-portrait. She's a very talented charcoal artist and painter. And it's a portrait of her looking pissed off. And it says, stop telling women to smile.
Right.
And she started pasting that in her neighborhood where she was getting hassled. And then she started emailing her friends and talking to her friends and was like, what do you not like that men say to you on the street? And doing portraits of them with stuff like, my name isn't baby, for instance. And they started putting those over. And at this point, like, she's in all these museums. She has a book out. She worked at Spike Lee. She did stuff in Paris, in Mexico City. And I think that because she was doing something that was true and that was to herself, but she was doing it with so much skill, right? And with so much discipline.
Yeah, right.
And going out every night, you know, risking arrested, getting arrested, putting these things up. That combination is why she was successful. Whereas I think that if she tried to be one of these, like, sterile SEO managed things and was like, what's popular, that wouldn't have been successful. Yeah.
So interesting. Molly Crabapple was just in town for the Chicago Humanities Festival. Her new book, co-written with Marwan Hisham, is called Brothers of the Gun, A Memoir of the Syrian War. You can also find her illustrated memoir, Drawing Blood, as well. Molly, great to have you here at the Big Table. Great to meet you, and continued success with your work.
Thank you so much for having me.